From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In bedrooms all across America, it's what's not happening that's making headlines. Sex isn't just going on the back burner, it's going out the bedroom window. More than 40 million Americans have a low-sex or no-sex marriage. Tonight on Point, America's sexual shutdown. When I do becomes I don't want to. But first, we begin with the latest news from France, where there is more evidence the continental divide over what to do about Iraq is deepening. President Jacques Chirac has told Central and Eastern European countries to keep their views on Iraq to themselves or risk losing their chance to join the European Union. France is also threatening to veto a United Nations Security Council resolution mandating force against Iraq. Keith Richbird is Paris bureau chief for The Washington Post. I asked him about new Europe's response to old Europe's outburst.
There's been criticism, but also some humor as they've tried to deflect it. Some have reminded Chirac, to use their words, that the European Union is a group of equals and that they're not children. I think it was the Romanian prime minister who said, you know, in Europe there are no daddies and mommies and kids. The Polish prime minister said that obviously, you know, Chirac must be angry at the Americans. And he said, you know, when he's mad at his own wife, he takes it out on his children. So that seems to be what Chirac is doing now. But there's been a real mixture of kind of anger and disbelief at what was really just considered a tirade.
For anyone who may have missed it, what did Chirac say exactly?
Well, he was commenting on the fact that a lot of the Eastern European countries, and 10 of them are going to be joining the EU, and others are, and 3 of them are candidates to join in the next round of enlargement. He was angered that they so publicly sided with the United States on the Iraq issue. That is, they were in the camp saying that time has run out for Saddam Hussein, and that now is the time to really think about going to war. And Chirac's comments were that they, in his words, quote, missed a great opportunity to shut up, and that this might prejudice their chances of becoming full members of the European Union, and that they really should learn not to side so closely with America. It was really, really an incredible comment coming from a head of state.
How unusual is it for a president to be that undiplomatic?
It's unusual, but, you know, these are really unusual times. I mean, we've had these volleys coming across the Atlantic. We've had Donald Rumsfeld making really the phrases old Europe and new Europe that just infuriated people here. We've heard Condoleezza Rice last Sunday on television talking about appeasement, a word that really bristles here. We've had comparisons during the German election campaign of President Bush to Hitler in his tactics. So this Iraq debate has really rubbed feelings raw on both sides of the Atlantic, and we've had some really pointed barbs being hurled back and forth. And this was just the most caustic, but just the latest in this sort of series of jibes slinging back and forth between normally diplomatic people.
And beyond the raw feelings, what's the story behind the story here in terms of what Chirac is trying to accomplish in terms of France's place in the world and particularly in Europe?
You know, it's interesting. It comes as France has been really feeling itself under threat, its traditional position as an engine or leader of Europe under threat. And Rumsfeld actually touched on something when he mentioned that the center of gravity in Europe is moving further east. Once the European Union expands, it's going to be represented by a lot more Eastern Europeans. Berlin will be closer to the center of what is the European Union than Paris is now. German and English are becoming rapidly the languages of business and of the new European Union, as opposed to French, which is becoming a shrinking language. And France is finding its place in the Union and in the world really under challenge and under threat. And in some sense, that's what's really driving this opposition to the American policy on Iraq, this whole idea that it can't be done unilaterally by the United States. Any war has to come with Security Council approval, and it's no coincidence that it's on the Security Council that France has a permanent veto. That's why it's a world power.
Well, if France is trying hard not to be elbowed aside, who else is standing with it other than Germany?
Well, they've got some silent partners. I mean, Belgium is there, some of the small countries. Belgium is there, Luxembourg is there. But also, if you look a bit further north, Scandinavian countries. Finland is basically on that side. Sweden is also in the peace camp. Austria is in the peace camp. They've said, for example, that American troops cannot transit across Austrian soil on their way to fight in Iraq and cannot use Austrian airspace. You know, big problem for the Bush administration. So the European Union, the current 15 members, are about evenly split, with the British, Italian, Spanish, and Dutch camp basically backing the U.S. position, France and Germany, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Swedes, the Finns on the other side. But it's the Eastern Europeans, those 13 Eastern Europeans, that really tip the balance and make it a more pro-American grouping. And that's what's really behind Chirac's outburst.
And what about Chirac's warning that opposing France and Germany on this could hurt those candidates for European Union membership? Is that likely?
Well, I don't think it's likely. I don't think France could really take the issue that far. I mean, you know, I think he was reminded in this huge crush of commentary coming at him that, you know, these are sovereign countries. They can make their own decisions as to what they want to do. As Tony Blair put it in his own press conference, you know, he said, surely no one is suggesting that they aren't equal members with rights to take whatever positions they want. I don't think it'll come back to hurt them, but they're going to be coming into a union with a sworn enemy in France, and that's not what you want. They're one of the biggest countries in the union, and still what they say carries some weight because of their size and their history as one of the founding members of the EU.
And in some way, could you argue that the so-called Gang of Eight fired the first volley in this when they came up with a letter supporting the U.S. position on Iraq without apparently mentioning it to some of the other members of the European Union?
That's what really, really angered some people in the old Europe camp, that this letter came out, signed by some Eastern Europeans, but also by the Italians, the Spanish, and others, without even consulting the foreign policy bureaucracy of the European Union. However, that letter came out after Chirac and Gerhard Schroeder of Germany, during ceremonies marking the 40th anniversary of the friendship treaty between those two, came out with a pretty strong statement saying that war should be a last resort. And the fellows who signed that letter of eight will turn around and say, well, the German-French statement was not coordinated with anyone either, and they were claiming to be speaking for Europe. So it's been a really bad few weeks for the Europeans and a bad few weeks for the idea of having a common European policy. They've been all over the map. They've been shouting at each other. They've been using very undiplomatic language. It's really been a bad time for Europe.
Certainly sounds as if tempers are running pretty high there. What do you see as the next phase in the old Europe, new Europe rift?
Well, I think the next question is going to be whether or not there's a Security Council resolution proposed by the United States and Britain. If that does happen, France is saying they would veto it. And the Prime Minister, Raffarin, said just yesterday on Tuesday that France would use its veto. They wouldn't want to. They'd first like to get a majority against any new resolution that would authorize force against Saddam Hussein. But he said France would be willing to use their veto. And Germany, don't forget, Germany's still a member of the Security Council, a non-veto, non-permanent member, but they're still there. Their vote counts as well. So we can still see the split going on now, moving from Europe back to New York.
Thank you so much, Keith.
Thank you.
Keith Richberg is the Paris bureau chief for The Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from Paris. No sex, please. We're married, screeches New York Magazine's headline. Sexless marriages are an epidemic, warns TV's Dr. Phil. And Whatever Happened to Marital Sex is featured in this month's Atlantic Monthly magazine. Marriage used to provide access to sex, writes Caitlin Flanagan. Now it provides access to celibacy. And it's not just the women who say no. Anger, hurt, exhaustion, unmatched libidos are driving a wedge between couples in bed and sending many straight to the therapist's couch. Are we becoming a pleasure-averse society? Why isn't making love important enough to make time for? Or does society place too much emphasis on sex? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now on the line from Burbank, California, is Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Her article, The Wifely Duty, appears in the February issue. Hi, Caitlin.
Hello.
So glad you could join us. I have to ask, what prompted you to write about this in the first place, and what response have you gotten?
To the first question, I don't have a very good answer. When you were describing the piece and the entire topic of the show, I had this sinking feeling of what have I gotten myself into? But I shall rise to the occasion and say that I had an odd experience last winter when several people, one after another, each unrelated to the other, confessed to me that they were not having sex in their marriage. And I tucked that away and thought that was very odd, but didn't think too much of it. And then my editor at The Atlantic, Ben Schwartz, who's a very brilliant guy and an historian and an intellectual, but also someone who very much has his ear to the ground, picked up the phone from Boston and called me here in California. And he said, you know, I think something's going on here. I keep hearing reports like this. People keep saying this. And there's, of course, an old saying in journalism that news is what happens to your editor's friends, and we didn't want to get in that kind of a situation. So we sat on it for a while. But, you know, I realized that if you turn on the daytime women's talk shows, which I watch rather happily and obsessively, this is discussed all the time. It's just sort of accepted as truth. And if you read the mass circulation women's magazines, they absolutely never go to press without some kind of article that addresses the fact that there's a sexual shutdown and how in the world to get things started again. I would say that the response has certainly been larger than to my previous pieces on housekeeping and anti-clutter campaigns, so that may just be the nature of sex, but as a topic. But people seem to be very interested in this, and people are talking about it a lot now, I think.
Tell me a little bit more about the quote we just mentioned, where you said in the article that marriage used to provide access to sex, and now it provides access to celibacy. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, Ben and I were talking about it, and originally I was for that. It's part of the title, kind of the underline of the title or the subhead. And I was saying, yeah, maybe we should have something about how busy people are and how tired they are and that they're therefore not having sex because of these very busy lives that people lead nowadays. But then we said, no, there's really something different at play than just plain old exhaustion. And then we talked about it and we decided that it seems to be that what you're getting out of marriage, that there used to be this notion that sexuality was part of a married woman's life. That was just, there was an expression when I was a girl in the 1970s, older women would say to you, oh, I'm an old married woman. And what a woman would mean to that when she was talking to a girl was that I'm a sexually experienced woman. And nowadays women who are married don't really mention that a lot. It's kind of single women who seem to be much more in the world having sexuality as part of their daily lives or part of their experience more than married women.
And all of which, I guess, has made you wonder whether those women in the 1950s were perhaps a lot more active than some of today's supposedly more liberated and experienced married women.
Well, I think there are a few topics less helpfully examined via sweeping generalizations than the erotic life of married people, and a lot of people were very furious with that part of the piece. But I have to say that there was a notion in the 1950s, and I'm not saying it's a good notion, I'm not saying it's a bad notion, but there was a notion that a woman had certain responsibilities within a marriage. And those responsibilities include all the things that we talk about all the time, the children and the husband and the housekeeping, but that sexuality and that fulfilling her husband's sexual needs were also contained within her set of responsibilities. And certainly many women and, you know, modern women have thrown out a lot of that and said, those things don't belong to me anymore. I'm not responsible solely for the children. I'm not responsible solely for the housekeeping. And I'm certainly not going to think that one of my responsibilities in the marriage is to provide sex. So the game has very much changed within a marriage in all sorts of ways. And I think that's also affected the kind of attitudes married women have towards their husband's sexual desires and towards their own sexual desires within a marriage.
And what about the advice that was given to married women in earlier generations? Things like get dinner out of the way first thing so that you can be rested and relaxed and able to welcome your husband home.
Well, there was certainly the notion that when your husband came home from work, if you look at, there's something on the internet now that I mentioned in the piece, which is purports to be advice from a home economics textbook from the 1950s. And people read it a lot. I was at a dinner party once where someone read it and everybody was laughing. And I was laughing. And the idea was that before your husband came home, you were going to make sure the children were clean and quiet. And you were going to make sure that dinner was ready. And you were going to make sure that he had a bit of rest and recuperation. And there was a notion back then that his day at the office, which was so much shorter than a contemporary white-collar office day, that it was depleting and it was exhausting and that he was going to need to recharge a little bit after work and that that might lead to all sorts of things. And one might infer also it would be sort of a sexual tonic if someone were to have some respite and some relaxation after work. But nowadays, both husband and wife are often roaring through the door to be, you know, met by children who haven't seen them all day, and there's dinner and there's so many things to contend with, and there is just plain old exhaustion, I think. That's probably lending itself to this situation.
You can certainly understand why two rough days would lead people to want to just fall into bed at the end of the night.
Well, when it's combined with tremendous familiarity, I can. I had some very exhausting days in college, which ended more happily than that. But yes, I think that you combine the, you know, grinding responsibility of marriage and housekeeping and children, and these other dynamics at play, yeah, I think that may happen.
We're talking tonight about America's sexual shutdown, why the marriage bed might as well be twin beds. Are we becoming a pleasure-averse society? Why aren't married couples making more time for making love? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about love and intimacy in marriage. How important is physical intimacy to marital happiness? Has the media bombarded us with sex for so many years that it's lost its mystery? Is America becoming pleasure-averse? We'd like to hear from you. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been speaking with Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Her article, The Wifely Duty, appears in the February issue. And joining us now from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is Michelle Wiener Davis. She is a marital therapist and author of the new book, The Sex-Starved Marriages. And Michelle, welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me, Gail. I'm delighted to be in such good company. I'm so appreciative of having Caitlin on the phone as well, because I loved her article, and I thought it was just wonderful.
Well, I think for a lot of people, this came as big news. Obviously not to you.
Well, being a marriage therapist for two decades, it's hardly big news that couples are missing having sexuality in their relationship. And I was thrilled that, you know, with Caitlin's article. And yet I think it's only half the story, because it's a story about women and their relationships. As a marriage therapist, I can tell you that I'm convinced that one of America's best-kept secrets is that women don't have a corner on the low libido market, and that men, really, I think there are millions of men who are not interested in sex, and their sexual machinery works just fine, but they're not interested for many of the same reasons that women aren't interested. Unfortunately, though, their sense of self is so wrapped up in their virility that they're shamed, and they're not talking about it. Because they're not talking about it, they're not getting the help that they need. And the women who are married to them aren't, you know, talking about it in the women's locker rooms. And so they're thinking they're the only women in the world whose husbands aren't chasing them around the house with a permanent erection. And so there's a loss of self-esteem there as well. So the first message I want to get out is that this is not a gender-specific issue, although I definitely, you know, women are much more likely to be talking about it. I think part of the issue, too, is that, you know, and we were talking about the women in the 50s, and, you know, back then, I totally agree, it was sort of part of the marital expectation, in a sense, you know, perhaps these Stepford wives needed to care for their husband's sexual needs. And I think that with the 60s and the 70s and, you know, moving into the me generation, people became much more consumed with taking care of their own needs. And I think really what's happening now, or what should be happening, is more of a focus on mutual caretaking. And, you know, good marriages are really based on really caring what your spouse needs and wants and being responsive to that. And we know that when it comes to decisions about, you know, household decisions, who's going to take care of the kids, who's going to do what around the house, where you're going to live, how much time to spend with in-laws. But noticeably missing from that mix is really caring about your spouse's sexual needs.
Michelle, this is all really good general information. Let me ask you some specifics. I mean, what are people telling you when they come into you for counseling? Could you share some of those specific stories for us?
Well, let me give you a vignette, okay? I'll call the couple Joe and Mary. Joe made mention of the fact that they'd been married for 15 years, and he said that there really is only a two-hour window of opportunity on Saturday nights from 10 to 12 when his wife is responsive to his advances. And I turned over to Mary, and without hesitation, she says, yes, that's absolutely true. That's the only time of the week, and if I'm not interested, I'm not interested. And I turned back to Joe, and I said, Joe, tell me what that's like for you. And probably for the first time in their marriage, he looked at her, and he said, you know, when I lie in bed next to you, and I reach out for you, and you're not there for me, I feel incredibly depressed. I feel rejected. I start to wonder whether you really love me anymore, whether you're attracted to me. And when you go to sleep and I stare up on the ceiling, there's no lonelier feeling in the world than I have lying in bed next to you. And with that, I noticed that Mary's eyes were filling with tears, and she reached out and grabbed for his hand, and she said, "You know, Joe, I have never, not once in the history of our marriage, ever thought about what it's like to be in your shoes or to lie on your side of the bed. I am so, so sorry." And as a marriage therapist, it was, you know, even someone who's been a veteran doing it for 20 years, it was a very poignant moment.
I know we have a lot of callers who really want to get in on this conversation. Touching story for sure. Let's go to Jerome, who's standing by on the line. Jerome, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Great show. I read the Caitlin's piece in The Atlantic and enjoyed it. A couple questions. One was, there wasn't a whole lot of empirical evidence there, and I'm kind of wondering what the data says about the frequency of these kinds of marriages. And then second, as a someone who's got two young kids, I understand the exhaustion argument, and I really appreciate what you just said about the lack of teamwork in a lot of relationships. That's one thing that struck me about the article, that many of the women highlighted seem to be sort of disinterested in the men's feelings. I don't necessarily think they were a representative sample, but I found that to be a really interesting thing that was missing from there.
Caitlin and Michelle, let me ask you both. We've seen figures about 40 million Americans who are in these low-sex or no-sex marriages. Does that confirm what you find?
That's a figure that's familiar to me, as well as one out of every three marriages. But I wanted to comment on what he just said about women being insensitive and that not being the rule. It's not that women are insensitive. There are millions of women out there, along with the help with Oprah Winfrey, who, because they need to feel close on an emotional level very often in order to want to be sexual, cannot fathom why their husbands would want to be close physically if there isn't that connection. And so they attempt to explain it to themselves, and the only explanation they come up with is that it must be a biological urge, like scratching an itch. But I am here to tell you that although sometimes it is scratching an itch, the vast majority of men in my practice tell me just the opposite, that for them, in the same way that words and spending time together are a means of connection for women, touching and being close physically is a means of connection for men, and oftentimes the more physical spouse, not just men.
Caitlin, you also wrote about a very interesting other component of this, and that is power, that relationships are different now than they were before.
Right. I have to, in the spirit of complete candor, say that ever since Michelle described husbands running around the house with a permanent erection, my heart has been pounding, and I've thought, nice Irish Catholic girl should not go into this, but I'll stick with it. And simply say that, yes, when you think about the woman of old, she didn't have a lot of economic power. She didn't have a lot of power beyond the house. And in complicated and really rather sad ways, sexuality was one of the ways that she perhaps gained some power within the marriage. And we all remember or have heard of that notorious old book from the early 70s called The Total Woman by Maribel Morgan. And she was shockingly sort of explicit about the way that women could get new refrigerators and gifts of rose bushes and 90s from their husbands.
If only they would meet them at the door with saran wrap. I remember that one.
Exactly right. But I must say on that subject that Diane Sawyer recently interviewed Maribel Morgan, and Diane was really trying to give it to Maribel and said, "Don't you really regret what you said about that saran wrap?" And Maribel Morgan was great, and she gave it right back to Diane and said, "You know, with all the great new colors of saran wrap, I think it would be an even better idea now than then." But, I think that certainly women don't feel that they need to be sexual in order to gain sort of economic parity within the household. And I certainly don't think it's a bad thing that they no longer need to do that. And as I said in the piece, I think it was sort of outrageous that they ever did. But I think that's certainly contributing to what's going on a good deal.
But don't you think it's been carried a little bit too far? They don't need it for economic gain. But women, not women, the person with low sexual desire, sometimes the man, by the way, feels that they don't need to invest themselves for all sorts of reasons. They just, if they're not in the mood, they simply don't have to do it.
I think you're exactly right about that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, let's bring Rebecca into the conversation. Rebecca, you've been waiting patiently online. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if the speakers can comment on the extent to which the epidemic of undiagnosed depression, especially among men, factors into celibate marriages, since it has such a quelling effect on the libido. Mm-hmm.
I can certainly tell you that in my practice it is a factor. I don't have statistics for you. And unfortunately, many people are left untreated with depression, which is, and you know, a libido buster for sure. And then, unfortunately, sometimes when they're treated with certain antidepressants, they often dampen desire too. You have to be really careful about the kind of antidepressant that you're taking if you want to maintain your desire level.
So far, we've been talking mostly about women. We have mentioned men a little bit, but I want to bring in David Schnarch, who is joining us from Evergreen, Colorado. He is a clinical psychologist, certified sex therapist, and author of Resurrecting Sex, Resolving Sexual Problems, and Rejuvenating Your Relationship. Hi, David.
Hello, Gail.
Clearly, it's not just women who are saying no to sex. Men are, too. What's going on?
Well, nothing new. It's just that people are so surprised that a man could have difficulty because men have to struggle with the picture of a real man wants to go anytime, anywhere, and it turns out that men have low sexual desire in about half of all the cases of low sexual desire. So it's just about as frequently occurring in men as in women. It just comes as a big shock to both men and women that men have the same difficulty, and that's part of the problem.
Zach, you've been waiting online. What's your question or comment?
My comment is this. I think a lot about sex. And I think
God love you, Zach.
I think the media, the sex-saturated society that we now live in, may be having an influence, a negative influence, on sex in long-term committed relationships. Because it seems that sexual fantasy is so easily attained online, just seeing commercials in magazines, on the newsstand. And I wonder what influence that's actually having on your partner, who isn't necessarily as attractive as the person, you know, you can find online.
Thanks for the comment, Zach. Let me send that one to David first. And I wonder as well, because we're bombarded with sexual images all the time, has that taken some of the mystery out of it?
No, I think that this media does have an impact, but it hasn't taken the mystery out of it because for most of us, the person lying next to us in bed is still a mystery. Part of what creates low desire is when people get afraid to say what they really want and show who they really are. Then they end up going to the internet because it's easier. But it isn't, I think, because the mystery has gone out of sex. It's because the natural and inevitable processes of emotionally committed relationships, the things that make relationships good and strong, also diminish desire in both men and women. So once we get over the libido notion that desire is a biological drive that comes out full bore unless something is in the way, that's the old model from the last 40 years, when we begin to realize that just being in an emotionally committed relationship will both kill desire in the midpoint of a marriage, but also make you capable of profound desire to shift from biological drive to actually choosing your partner and having sex with them because you love them, not because you want to scratch an itch. That is the natural processes that emotionally committed relationships go through, and that's why both men and women have low desire in the middle of their marriages.
And what are some of the stories that you hear, David, particularly from men?
About half the couples that we see, the man is the low desire. He feels bad because he thinks he's supposed to be like John Wayne in bed. And so he usually goes underground. And since so many women have also been taught that it's their attractiveness to others that is the good measure of their desirability, when these men go underground about sex, the same thing that drives women crazy and drives them to get facelifts is also the same things that makes their sense of self-worth crater when their men don't want desire. And since so many women think they're supposed to be the recipient of the initiations and not the person who makes it, I think it's a particular problem for couples when the man is the low desire partner, and it hits both the man and the woman.
Chris is joining us now on the line. Chris, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Just a quick comment. I'm 28. I'm divorced. And throughout my 20s, it's been very easy to meet with many, many different women, meet up with many different women, and I'm dating someone else again seriously, and it seems like marriage to me is not about sex. It's more about other responsibilities, our work lives, our adult lives. And it's almost like that next step of getting married again won't be about sex, but it'll be about other things. And it's almost like you know, sex is more of a singles type of a situation. You know, having sex with many, many different women, it's easy. I mean, women today are as active sexually as men. And it seems like that's the priority to have sex. If I wanted just sex, I would stay single, but I want more from my life than just sex. And it seems like that's the progression in my life to the next step.
Michelle, if Chris were sitting in your office, what would you be telling him?
You know, what he's saying really flies in the face of a recent research, a rather large study, that says that if you want, you know, more and better sex, don't be single and don't be divorced. Stay in long-term marriage. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who's married is satisfied, but you're in a better position to be satisfied in a long-term marriage, not being single.
Chris, what do you think?
Well, again, it wasn't, well, I guess for me, it wasn't my choice to become divorced. I guess I'm a strong person. Most of the women I date and my ex-wife was a strong person as well. I guess when it comes to strong people, I don't know. I think there's the opportunity out there to really strive for more. And, like I said, it wasn't my choice to become divorced. And at this point, it just seems to me it's very easy to get sex when I'm out at the clubs or I'm out at the bars or I'm out meeting women. And, again, I want more from my life than just that. That's not what I'm looking for. I want a solid relationship. And with my girlfriend, we've been dating for 6 months now, sex has become not the priority that other things are. We enjoy going to the museum. We enjoy going out to movies. We go out to dinner. But when we get home, it's sex isn't always the top of our heads. You know, it's other things that really make our relationship great.
Thanks so much for the call, Chris. Caitlin, I'm wondering, the people that you spoke to, both men and women, were they forthcoming? I mean, were they as honest as some of these callers are being?
Well, what's interesting is Michelle and David were both speaking about how it's an equal problem, but I think that men and women speak about it and talk about it very, very differently. I think when women talk about the fact that they're not having sex with their husbands, they do it in a kind of sardonic way and in a kind of gleeful way and in a sneaky kind of getting back at the husband's way.
I agree.
And it's a kind of wounding thing, whereas I don't think men would ever, although certainly by definition I've never been with a group of men who, you know, just on their own, but I really don't think men would sit around and say, boy, she really wants it and I never give it to her and she's always coming on to me and I always cut her off. And I think it's a very disrespectful and hurting and wounding thing to do to someone. And I'm always very interested that women are so willing to do that to their husbands, yet men won't do that to their wives.
Makes you wonder what else is going on in the relationship, doesn't it?
It does.
But also, I think there's another issue at play here, and that is I don't think men like to admit publicly that they're not satisfying their wife's sexual needs because there's too much shame involved. But I'd like to introduce another, you know, aspect to all of this. And
you'll need to do it quickly, Michelle, because we need to take a break.
Okay, well, I'll do it after the break. How's that?
Okay. That probably sounds like a good idea.
Okay.
Hold the thought, though. We are discussing marital intimacy and the startling statistic that as many as 40 million married couples may have low sex or no sex marriages. How important is a physical relationship to marital happiness? Are we becoming too busy for pleasure? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking about sex and marriage and when I do becomes I don't want to. Has the fast-paced clicker culture lost its ability for true intimacy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Caitlin Flanagan joins us from Burbank, California. She's a contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine, and her article, The Wifely Duty, appears in the February issue. With us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is Michelle Wiener Davis, marital therapist and author of the new book, The Sex-Starved Marriage. And from Evergreen, Colorado, is David Snarsh, clinical psychologist, certified sex therapist, and author of Resurrecting Sex, Resolving Sexual Problems and Rejuvenating Your Relationship. And Michelle, we promised you the first word.
Thanks. You know, I started to notice years ago in my practice that many people who considered themselves to have low desire would make the comment, you know, Michelle, I wasn't in the mood when I started making love, but once I got into it, I really, really enjoyed myself. It felt great. I felt a lot of desire. And it really got me questioning this whole issue of sexual desire. What does it actually mean? You know, there is a multi-billion-dollar industry that is focused on helping people diagnose why they're not feeling desire and coming up with either medical or biological treatments or perhaps emotional or interpersonal treatments to fix what's wrong in the relationship. But the truth is that there is some recent research that indicates that for millions of people, sexual desire doesn't just happen. There's no random thought, like perhaps if you're, you know, writing bills or making a meal or you're sitting at your computer, you're not going to have that lusty thought that's going to propel you toward the bedroom. Instead, if you allow yourself to be receptive to your spouse's advances, the kind of physical pleasure that you get from that will lead to a sense of arousal and a sense of desire. And I think that in some ways we've been looking at this whole issue of desire upside down.
Billy's calling now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Billy. What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
The reason I'm calling is that I just wanted to make a comment. I just believe and that we will always have a problem sexually, whether it's male-female relationships, male-male, female-female relationships, until we realize that we are spiritual beings encased in physical bodies, and the whole act of sexuality and a sexual experience is to help each other awaken that beautiful divine nature in each other, that peace and that love, and that sharing that goes with that act. We will always have that problem. I believe that's why the whole sexual act was designed in the first place. It's to help each other become aware of their true self and their true nature and to help each other grow spiritually. And until then, we will always have a problem.
Thanks for the comment, Billy. David, what's your response?
My response is Billy couldn't be more right, but for a different reason than he's talking about. He's talking more about where we should get to. The reason why couples have sexual desire problems is because it is the methodology of how they get that. To get to the point that you really recognize your partner as a sexual and also a separate spiritual being, you have to go through the sense of communigenitals in a monogamous relationship. And when you have the feeling that your partner is running your behind, you usually don't want to share the front end as well. And so the very processes of feeling controlled by your partner and also feeling pressured by your partner to have sex forces you to grow up, and it makes you mature so that you become capable of exactly the kind of recognition and spirituality and sexuality that Billy is referring to. The joke is, though, that when most of us are having desire problems, we're always approaching it as what's going wrong. We never approach it as what's going right. So both the book Passionate Marriage and also Resurrecting Sex describe why normal, healthy couples have sexual difficulties, including desire problems, because everything's going right, nothing's going wrong. It's a non-pathological approach. And as long as we approach desire as libido, we're still going to be doing what sex therapy has done for the last 40 years, to assume that you should have desire and assume that you should have sexual function, unless you're excused with a doctor's note or you think there's something screwed up with you or your partner. And just thinking that way creates low desire problems. And so I very much agree with Billy's point. The point is the methodology is built right into the problems that we have.
Well, let me be devil's advocate for just a minute here, because what of the marriages where both couples may not be having sex, but that is perfectly fine with them? Their relationship is fine. They like each other, love each other. Maybe they hug, you know. Maybe sex just isn't important to them. Isn't that okay, too?
You bet. And in fact, those are the relationships they wouldn't even describe the fact that they don't have sex as a problem. But it's the disparateness of sexual desire where one partner wants sex or the other doesn't. And very often, celibate relationships are enforced celibacy. They're not agreed upon because the low desire partner always has control of sex and usually also has control of their partner's adequacy and feelings about themselves as well. So that's why the lack of sex becomes problematic. It tears away at our feelings about ourselves because most people never get married with a solid sense of themselves. You think you're going to get into a relationship and that other person is going to prop you up and tell you who you are, validate you, and have sex with you to boot. And lo and behold, when they don't want to have sex, because we don't like having sex with the people that we have to depend on. We don't like wanting the people that we feel we need. That is built right into marriage, and then that's why couples have difficulty.
Michelle, let me get a quick response from you on that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, in addition to that, and I agree with David, in addition to that, though, it's more what happens is it's not only that sex is not happening, it's the misunderstanding that leads to a total lack of intimacy, not only physical intimacy. It's when people stop sitting next to each other on the couch. They stop laughing at each other's jokes. They stop having meaningful glances. They stop being friends. And I really believe that it puts marriages at risk for infidelity and even divorce. And, you know, in millions of marriages across the country, there's this implicit or tacit agreement, you know, I don't need to care about your sexual needs, but I expect you to be monogamous. And furthermore, I expect you not to complain about it. And I just think that that's unfair and it's unworkable.
But what if it really is okay with them? If they can be great friends but just aren't interested, thank you.
If it is okay with both of them, then it's okay. I don't think there are any universal rules about that. However, as David pointed out, it's very often as a result of not successfully negotiating their differences.
All right, Caitlin, you get the last word here. You started all this in some ways. Can you give us a summary of where you think life and sex and love and marriage are and celibacy in 2003?
Once David described the term communigenitals, I thought, to paraphrase Dorothy Gale, I don't think we're on NPR anymore. It just seemed that we're kind of in a, I don't really know what to say about these topics. I think the other two guests are far more expert in those fields than I am.
But you did make the point at the end of your article, if I'm remembering correctly, that you would encourage couples to give it a try because it's your belief, or seems to be, that it is worth making that effort.
I think the one word that none of us has said, and that's a quite sad word to be omitted from the conversation, is romance. And I think it is possible still to include romance in marriage. And I think romance and sexuality are in some mysterious way bound up together. And I would hate to think of marriage becoming a sexless state.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of my guests very much. Caitlin Flanagan, who joined us from Burbank. She's contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine, and her article, The Wifely Duty, appears in the February issue. Also, Michelle Wiener-Davis, who joined us from Fort Lauderdale. She's a marital therapist and author of the new book, The Sex-Starved Marriage, A Couple's Guide to Boosting Their Marriage Libido. And to David Schnarch, who joined us from Evergreen, Colorado, clinical psychologist, certified sex therapist, and author of Resurrecting Sex. And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, North Korea through the eyes of a Korean American. This is On Point. From the time New York writer Soo Ki Kim was a young girl, she heard about her missing uncle who was last seen in 1950 when his home city of Seoul came under attack in the Korean War. Determined to find out what happened to him, Kim convinced the North Korean government to grant her a visa so that she could investigate. But when she arrived in Pyongyang, she realized that the North Korean government had no interest in helping her find out what had happened to her uncle. What they really wanted was a Korean youth from America to take part in ceremonies to hail the great leader, Kim Jong-il. Her trip culminated with her being invited to Kim Jong-il's 60th birthday party. Soo Ki Kim was no great fan of Kim Jong-il, but she played along as best she could and wrote about her experience in the New York Review of Books. In this radio diary, Soo Ki Kim reads an excerpt from her piece and reflects on her confusing but enlightening visit to North Korea.
My arrival was front page news in their Workers' Party paper. All of these things were happening. Each one was more strange than the previous. And I kept asking, so have you found out what happened to my uncle? And they kept saying, yes, we will. We will tell you. But I soon realized with each day that was not why I was invited. I'm constantly having to attend celebration events And finally, February 16th, which is the birthday of Kim Jong-il, the excerpt that I'm going to read takes place. When February 16 finally arrived, I was seated next to Park Kyung-nam, vice chairman of the Committee for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries, at a celebratory dinner which included delegates from Australia and Germany and a few selected party officials. It was clear that Park, a portly and rumpled man in his 60s, was the highest-ranking official there. Someone whispered that he worked directly under the great leader. I was told to fill his glass with Johnny Walker. Although his face was stern and menacing, he seemed to be imploring when he said it was up to people like me, second-generation Korean-Americans, to tell the world the truth about North Korea. He then urged me to try the pheasant ball soup and roe deer meat, which had been personally sent by the great leader. As the evening went on, the delegates grabbed the microphone and began singing pre-war North Korean tunes. A boyish man in his mid-40s, the Korean delegate from Germany, belted out a 60s South Korean pop song called Daejeon Blues, replacing Daejeon with Gwangju, the South Korean city of the bloody riots. I knew that it would soon be my turn. Choosing the right song seemed impossible until someone whispered, "Morning Dew." Of course, it made perfect sense. "Morning Dew," by the South Korean folk singer Kim Min-gi, has been the song of protest demonstrations in the South for decades. "When sorrow collects in my heart, bead by bead, like morning dew, finer than pearl between each leaf, after a long, wakeful night, I climb the morning hill and attempt a small smile. The sun rises red over the graves. The midday heat must be my trial. Here I come to that wild field. Here I come, leaving behind every sorrow." It had been years since I'd thought of that song. Certainly, I'd never imagined that in Pyongyang in 2002, surrounded by Workers' Party leaders, I would recall the South Korean students who had perished in the name of democracy and reunification. The room was still as I sweated through morning dew. Afterward, Vice Chairman Park patted me on the shoulder and offered me a shot of vodka. I looked at him, feeling sadder than I had felt the entire week. He, like me, my lost uncle, Yoo Tae-young, Kim Bong-ho, Lee Chang-il, Director Shin, Consul Bae, was part of what had once been a 5,000-year-old Confucian country called Korea. We all shared one thing. We deplored the existence of the 38th parallel. The evening ended with the party leaders all rising. Arm in arm, they sang the comrade's song. They were men driven by purpose. They believed that they were patriots. They lived for Kim Jong-il, who they were certain would reunite us. At that moment, I thought they looked happy. Yet, I could not stop crying.
Suki Kim is a writer living in New York City. She is the author of the recent book, The Interpreter. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by